What's happened, Socrates, to make you leave the places that you usually haunt in the Lyceum, coming here instead to spend your time at the King Archon's court? I can't believe the reason is that you are prosecuting someone, as I am, before the King Archon.
The Athenians do not refer to what I'm doing here as prosecution. Rather, it is called indictment, Euthyphro.
What's this you say? It must be someone has indicted you, for I cannot believe that you will say you're here to bring a case against another.
Indeed, that's so.
So there is someone else who's brought a case against you?
Yes.
Who's that?
Myself, I do not know him, Euthyphro. Apparently, he's young and is unknown. I think I've heard them call him Meletus. His home is in the Pythian Deme, and so, if you know anyone called Meletus from there, whose hair is long, whose beard is short, whose nose is rather beak-like, that is he.
I do not know him, Socrates. What is the charge he's brought against you?
What's the charge? One that I deem is not ignobly brought. For it's worth noting when a man his age claims knowledge of a subject so important. He says he's figured out the ways in which the young men of our city are corrupted. And more than that, he claims that he can prove which man is guilty of corrupting them. He must be wise. He sees my ignorance, he says, corrupting fellow citizens. He brings a claim against me to the city, as if he were reporting to their mother. Of all our public men, I think that he is just the one who starts the proper way. For it is right to seek above all else to make the young as good as possible, just as a farmer who is any good bestows his care upon the youngest plants before he tends the others. Meletus, in just this way, clears out the ones of us who harm the youngest shoots, or so he says. Then later he will tend the older ones. I think he'll give great blessings to the city. This seems a likely outcome when one starts, as he has.
I'd be glad if that were true, O Socrates. However, I'm afraid the opposite is likely to occur. It seems to me, by going after you, he harms our city, striking at its heart. Please tell me, what does he believe you've done to make him say that you corrupt the young?
The things he claims I do are really strange. He says I'm a creator of new gods, that I, believing in the gods I've made, reject the older ones, that for their sake he has indicted me. That's what he says.
I think I understand this, Socrates. You claim that you have access to a sign that is divine, and so he's brought this claim against you as a man who seeks new ways of practicing religion, and he's here in court to slander you, because he knows that he can easily misrepresent the things you do to the assembled crowd. I've seen the same reaction in my case. Whenever I'm addressing the assembly and touch on subjects that might seem divine and seek to tell the future, they all laugh and tell me I am crazy, yet not once have I foretold a thing that didn't happen. They're jealous of the ones who have this power. I think one shouldn't heed them. It is best to stand one's ground and meet them face to face.
Dear Euthyphro, perhaps one may endure such laughter, and it doesn't matter much. For the Athenians don't mind a man they think is clever, just so long as he does not impart his wisdom to another. But if they see him influencing others to think as he does, they react in anger. The anger comes from envy, as you say, or from some other reason.
Certainly, I have no eagerness to test their feelings towards me in connection with this matter.
Perhaps to them you're unavailable, unwilling to teach others of your wisdom. But I'm afraid that I enjoy discussions with people, so they think that I give out to all whatever I might have to say. I do it without charging any fee. Perhaps they think I'm eager to reward my listeners. If it were their intent to laugh as you have said they laugh at you, there'd be no harm. They'd spend their time in court in laughing and in jesting. But if they are serious, the outcome is less clear, except to future seers like yourself.
Perhaps it will be nothing, Socrates. I'm sure that you'll defend as you think best, as I'll present my case as best I can.
What case are you presenting, Euthyphro? And for the prosecution or defense?
The prosecution.
Who is the defendant?
Someone, they say, I'm crazy to pursue.
Is that because he'll easily escape?
The opposite is true. He's very old.
Who is it?
It's my father.
My dear sir, your father is the one you'll prosecute.
That's right.
What is the subject of the case? What is he charged with?
Murder, Socrates.
Good heavens, Euthyphro, most men would not agree it's right to prosecute that case. It seems that none could do a thing like this unless he were, in wisdom, far advanced.
Yes, Socrates, by Zeus, I think that's so.
Can I assume the man your father killed is one of your relations, or is that too obvious? for why would you pursue your father for the killing of a stranger?
I find that it is silly, Socrates, for you to think it makes a bit of difference whether the victim is a relative or is a stranger. All that one should ask is, was the killer's action justified? If it was just, then let him go. If not, then prosecute, for if he shares your hearth and table, then your act is just as bad as his if you keep company with him and fail to rid yourself and him of filth by bringing him to justice. Here, the victim was one of my dependents. When we farmed in Naxos, he was with us as a servant. In drunken rage, he killed a household slave. At this, my father bound him hand and foot and threw him in a ditch. He sent a man to Athens, telling him to ask the priest what should be done. As that was happening, he gave no thought or care about the servant, except, this man's a killer. If he dies, it is no matter. And, in fact, he died from hunger and from cold and from his bonds before the answer from the priest came back. My father and my other relatives are angry that I've brought a murder case against my father and on the behalf of one who'd killed. My father hadn't killed him, they say. Moreover, even if he had, the dead man is a killer who does not deserve a thought. They say it is impious to prosecute one's father for a murder. But their conception of the attitude the gods adopt towards impiety, and piety is wrong, O Socrates.
Whereas, by Zeus, your knowledge, Euthyphro, of the divine and of impiety, and piety, you think, is accurate, so that when all has happened as you say, you have no fear that it might be impious to prosecute your father as you wish.
I hardly would be useful, Socrates, and Euthyphro would not exceed most men in wisdom if I did not know the truth of all such things.
I think it most important, O Euthyphro, my admirable friend, that I become your student, for I'll challenge, regarding my indictment, Melitus, about these very matters, saying that I've always thought that knowing the divine was most important, so I want to learn. He says I recklessly create new concepts about the gods, so I've become your pupil. I'll tell him, Melitus, if you agree that Euthyphro is one who knows the truth in all these matters, then you should as well consider me to have the right beliefs and not bring me to trial. If you do not think this is so, then prosecute my teacher instead of me, for he is the corrupter of older men, of me and of his father. He teaches me and seeks to punish him. If Melitus does not agree, does not discharge me or start prosecuting you, I'll say these things again when I'm in court.
That's right, by Zeus, O Socrates. If he indicted me, I think that I would find the weak points of his case. The talk in court would be of Melitus and not of me.
I realize this, and so, for just this reason, I want to be your pupil, my dear friend. It seems some men, not least this Melitus, do not take notice when they look at you. But I stand out so sharply in his sight that he indicts me for ungodliness. But tell me now, by Zeus, what you just now maintained you clearly knew, what kind of thing that godliness and ungodliness are, regarding murder and in other things. Or is the pious not identical in every action, the impious act, the opposite of what is like itself, so that what is impious has one form and one appearance of impiety?
Most certainly it is one, Socrates.
Then tell me, Euthyphro, what is the pious, and what is the impious, do you say?
I say the pious is what I do now, to prosecute the criminal. The crime may be a murder, temple robbery, or anything. I say it doesn't matter who is the criminal, your father, mother, or anyone. To fail to prosecute is impious. Observe this, Socrates. I'll cite the law and proof of what I say. As I've explained to other men before, such actions are correct, for they disfavor ungodly persons, whoso they may be. These people all themselves believe that Zeus is best and is most righteous of the gods, and they agree he bound his father up for swallowing his sons without just cause, that he unmanned his father for this reason. These selfsame people are the very ones complaining when I prosecute my father for what he's done. They contradict themselves in speaking of the gods and of my actions.
Yes, Euthyphro, this is the reason why I stand as a defendant in my case. I can't accept the claims like this they make about the gods. I'm sure that this is why they'll tell me I do wrong. But now if you, who know about these claims, believe they're true, then I too must believe in them, it seems. For what am I to say, except I know that I myself lack knowledge of these matters? I ask you, tell me, by the god of friendship, do you in fact believe these claims are true?
Yes, Socrates, and more surprising things, of which most citizens are ignorant.
Do you believe in war among the gods? Hostilities and battles, all the things the poets tell, and all the sacred stories spun out by writers and depicted on the robe belonging to the goddess which is carried up to the Acropolis. Should we believe these stories, Euthyphro?
Yes, Socrates, and, as I said just now, I will, if you request, say other things about the gods that will make you amazed.
Of course, I'm not surprised, but you can tell these tales some other time when we are free. For now, I'd like to be more clear about what I asked you a little bit ago. For, my dear friend, you were not adequate in teaching me when asked what pious meant. Instead, you told me that what you do now, to prosecute your father's crime, is pious.
In this I spoke correctly, Socrates.
Perhaps. However, I think you'll agree that there are many other pious actions.
There are.
Then bear in mind, I did not ask to hear of one or two of many actions that we consider pious. Rather, I was asking of the form itself that makes all pious actions pious. You agreed that all impious actions are impious, and pious ones are pious through one form. Or do you not remember saying this?
I do.
Then tell me of the form itself, so I may look upon it and may say, with it as model, any act by you or by another of that kind is pious, or, if not of that kind, that it is not.
If that is what you are asking, Socrates, then I will tell you.
That is what I want.
In that case, what the gods hold dear is pious. Impiety is just what they do not.
That's splendid, Euthyphro. Now you have answered according to the question that I asked. The answer may be true or it may not. I don't know yet. However, I believe that you'll proceed to show me it is true.
I will.
All right, examine what we mean. An action or a man the gods hold dear is pious, while if hated by the gods, that action or that man must be impious. They're not the same. They are quite opposite. The pious and impious. Is that right?
Indeed it is.
The statement seems correct.
I think so, Socrates.
We have also said the gods are in a state of discord. They contend among each other, Euthyphro, that they have enmity against each other. Has that also been said?
Indeed it has.
What subjects cause their hatred and their anger? Let's look at it like this. If you and I disputed as to numbers, which is greater, would we be angry and be enemies? Or would we simply count and thus resolve the difference that we had?
Of course, we'd count.
Again, were you and I to disagree about which is the greater number, we would turn to measurement and cease to differ.
That's so.
About the heavier and lighter, we'd weigh the items and would reach accord.
Of course.
So on what subject could we differ so that we would be angry, would be hostile towards each other if we failed to reach a settlement? Perhaps you do not have an answer right away. Consider this. What of the just and unjust, beautiful and ugly, good and bad? Are these not those, the subjects for which difference causes rancor, so that when we can't find a way to reach agreement, you and I, indeed all men, react with anger and hostility?
Those are contentious subjects, Socrates.
Now what of gods who argue, Euthyphro? If gods are disagreeing, don't we think these subjects are the ones they fight about?
I certainly agree. It must be so.
But then, according to your argument, good Euthyphro, the gods are not consistent. The different ones consider different things as just or beautiful, ugly or good or bad. For how is it that they are fighting if they discuss these concepts and agree?
You're right.
And each likes just what he believes is beautiful or good or just and hates the opposite of that.
I think he does.
You say now that the same things that are just to some gods are by others held unjust, and as they fight about these matters, they are in a state of strife. Is that not so?
It is.
The same things, then, at once are loved and hated by the gods, and so these things are God-loved and God-hated.
That seems likely.
These things would all be pious and would be impious also on this argument.
I fear that this is so.
So you did not provide an answer, you astounding man, to what I asked. I did not ask you what same thing at once is pious and impious. But it appears that anything the gods may love is also something that they hate. It would not, therefore, be a bit surprising if your intended action punishing your father were a pleasing one to Zeus, but not to Cronos or to Ouranos, or it were pleasing to Hephaestus, but were not to Hera, so with other gods who differ with each other on this subject.
In answer, Socrates, I say no gods would differ on this subject. They agree, whoever has unjustly killed someone should pay the penalty.
Well, Euthyphro, have ever you heard someone say of one who's killed or has done something else unjust, that he should not be made to pay the price?
Of course I have. This happens all the time. In court and out in public, many men will do a wrong and then say anything in order to avoid the penalty.
Do they agree their actions, Euthyphro, are wrong, and do they say, in spite of this, that they should not be punished?
No, they don't. They don't agree with that.
So let's not claim they say or do just anything, for they refrain from saying this. They don't assert that they should be absolved of punishment for doing wrong. Instead, I think that they deny their acts are wrong. Is that not so?
That's true.
Then they do not dispute that one who's done a wrong deserves his punishment. Instead, they disagree on who did wrong, on what he did, and when.
Yes, you are right.
Does not the gods' experience agree if, as we say, they argue with each other about the just and unjust in the way that you maintain? Some claim a wrong is done, while others disagree, but none of them asserts that anyone who's done a wrong should go unpunished.
Yes, I think that's so, according to the main point, Socrates.
And those who disagree, both men and gods, dispute each action if indeed the gods engage in disagreements, as we say. Some say an act is just, while others call that self-same act unjust. Is that not so?
It is indeed.
Come now, dear Euthyphro, and tell me, so my wisdom can increase, what proof you have, in view of which you claim, a man was killed unjustly who became a murderer while he was in your service, was tied up by the master of his victim, and died while in his bonds before the one who bound him got an answer from the priest regarding what was right for him to do, and that his son does right to prosecute his father on behalf of such a man. Please show me, if you can, a sign the gods agree with you this act is in the right. If you can give a proof that's adequate, I shall extol your wisdom without end.
Perhaps this is no light task, Socrates, and yet I think a proof is possible.
You must believe my wits are duller than the jury's, for I know you'll show them that the killing was unjust and that the gods all hate such actions.
I will show just that, if only they will listen, Socrates.
They'll listen if they think you teach them well. A thought, though, came to me while you were speaking. Examining it now, I ask myself, if Euthyphro shows me without a doubt that all the gods believe this death unjust, what more is there that I have learned from him of piety and of impiety? This act, it seems, is hated by the gods, and yet the pious and impious are still not defined, for things the gods abhor are also, as we've argued, things they love. But I will not insist upon this point. Assume then, if you will, that all the gods agree with you the killing is unjust, so that they hate it. Is this what we say in our discussion now, that what the gods all hate is thus impious, what they love is pious, what some love and others hate is neither or is both? Is this how you believe we should proceed when we define what's pious and impious?
What is there that says we may not do this, Socrates?
For my part, I see nothing, Euthyphro. But you must ask yourself, do you believe this answer will most readily convey what you have promised that you will teach to me?
I'm certain when I tell you that the pious is what all gods love, and the opposite, what all the gods abhor, is the impious.
Then let's again examine whether that is sound, or should we rather let it pass? If one of us or someone else asserts a thing is true, do we accept its truth, or should we study what the speaker means?
We'll study it, of course, and yet I think the statement is a good one.
We shall soon know better whether what you say is true. Consider this. Is something that is pious loved by the gods because it is that way, or is it pious just because they love it?
I don't see where you're going, Socrates.
I'll try to clarify my explanation. We speak sometimes of something being carried, and other times of something carrying. We speak of something that is being led, and something else that's leading. And we speak of something being seen, and something seeing. You understand these things are different. You see as well the ways in which they differ.
I think I do.
There's something being loved, and something loving, and the two are different.
Of course.
Then tell me why something that's carried is being carried. Is it that someone is carrying it, or some other reason?
No, that's the reason.
And what's being led is so because someone is there to lead it. And what is being seen by virtue of the person there who sees it.
That's true.
It's not the case that someone sees it because it's being seen. Instead of that, it's being seen because of one who sees it. Nor are we wont to say that someone leads it because it's being led. Instead, we say it's being led because of one who leads it. Nor does a person carry any object because it's being carried. There exists, instead, someone who carries it, and so it's being carried. Is my meaning clear to you, O Euthyphro? Let me say this. When we say of a thing coming to be, we say this just because it comes to be, and not the opposite. And when we say that something is affected, we believe this is because of something that affects it, and not the opposite. Do you agree?
I do.
What's being loved is either that which comes to be or something that's affected.
That's certain.
The behavior is the same as with the things just mentioned. What is loved is not that way because it's being loved. Instead, it's being loved because it's loved by those who love it.
Necessarily.
What then are we to say about the pious, O Euthyphro? It must be something loved by all the gods in view of what you say.
It is.
And do we say that it is loved for being pious or another reason?
There is no other reason.
So it's loved because it's pious, and it's not the case. It's pious for the reason that it's loved.
That's true, apparently.
Because it's loved by all the gods, it's being loved and so is dear to them.
Of course.
The god beloved is therefore not the same thing as the pious, O Euthyphro, nor can the pious be the same as what is god beloved, as you assert. Instead, these two are different.
How is that, Socrates?
Well, we agree the pious is beloved for being pious, but is not pious for its being loved. Is that not so?
Yes.
On the other hand, the god beloved is so because it's loved by all the gods. The fact of being loved yields that result. But it is not the case. It's loved because it's God-beloved.
That's so.
But now if it were true the God-beloved and pious were the same, dear Euthyphro, and it were true the pious thing were loved because it's pious, then the God-beloved would, too, be loved because it's God-beloved. While if the God-beloved were God-beloved, by virtue that it's loved by all the gods, the pious would be pious, too, because of this, it's something loved by all the gods. These concepts, you observe, are opposites. One thing is love because of what it is, the other's what it is, something that's loved because it's loved. Therefore, I am afraid, O Euthyphro, that when you heard me ask, what's piety, you didn't try to make its nature clear to me. Instead, you gave an attribute or quality of it. To wit, the pious has the quality of being loved by all the gods, but you still haven't told me what the pious is. Now, if you would, don't hide a thing from me. Please, tell me once again from the beginning. What is it, piety? Whether it's loved by gods or has some other quality, let's not dispute this point. Please tell me what you say the pious and impious are.
But, Socrates, it seems that I cannot convey to you the thoughts I have in mind. For anything we say just goes around, refusing to stay put where we have placed it.
Your statements, Euthyphro, put me in mind of Daedalus, my ancestor. If I were making them, perhaps you would make fun and tell me, Socrates, just like your kin, you run away instead of staying put. These propositions, though, are yours, and so we need a different jest. They won't stay put, you say, for you. You don't say this of me.
I think this jest can serve us, Socrates, for I am not the one who makes our thoughts go round and fail to stay in the same place. It's you who are the Daedalus. If it were up to me, I'd keep them where they are.
I'm clever, it seems, than Daedalus, in how I use my skill, my friend, for he could move only the things he made himself. But I can move not only mine, it seems, but others also. And the smartest part of how I use my skill is that I'm clever in ways I don't intend. I'd rather see your statements firmly planted in the ground than I'd possess the wealth of Tantalus or rival Daedalus in cleverness. And yet, enough of this. I think you make unnecessary difficulties. Just like you, I hope that we can find a way that I can learn of piety. I won't give up before you do. See if you think that what is pious must also be just.
I think so, yes.
So is it then the case that all that's just is pious? Or perhaps, while pious things are just, not everything that's just is pious. Rather, some just things are pious and some not.
I do not follow what you are saying, Socrates.
Yet you are younger than I am, and that much wiser. I think the difficulties you create are products of the wisdom that you have. Collect yourself, dear sir. What I have said should not be hard to fathom. I maintain the opposite of what the poet wrote. You do not wish to say the name of Zeus. He did it. He's the reason that things grow. For where there's fear, there shame exists as well. I disagree. Now shall I tell you why?
Please do.
All right. I'm not inclined to think that where there's fear, there's shame exists as well. I think instead that many people fear disease and poverty and other things. They fear these things, but they are not ashamed of fearing them. Or do you disagree?
I do agree.
But where there's shame, there's fear. For is there anyone who feels ashamed and feels embarrassment at anything who does not also fear that others may perceive that he is wicked?
Certainly, that man's afraid.
So it's not right to say that where there's fear, there shame exists as well. Instead, let's say where shame is, there is fear. For fear is more expansive than is shame in what it covers. Shame's a part of fear in just the way that being odd is part of number. So it isn't true that where there's number, there is oddness, but that where there's oddness, there is number. Do you follow?
I do.
This is like what I asked before. I asked if where there's piety, there's justice. But where there's justice, it need not be true that piety exists. The property of being pious is a part of justice. Shall we adopt this, or a different claim?
Let's say it. What you said seems right to me.
Then see what's next. If it is true the pious is part of what is just, we must, it seems, find out what part of what is just it is. Now, if you ask about what we discussed, what part of number is the even, say, and what that number is, I would respond, it is the number that one can divide in two parts that are equal, not unequal. Or don't you think so?
Yes, I think that's true.
In this way, please explain to me what part of just the pious is, so that we may prevail on Meletus to stop the wrong he does against us by indicting me and saying I'm ungodly, since I've learned from you to know what's godly and what's pious and what is not.
It seems, O Socrates, the godly and the pious is the part of justice that's concerned with godly care, while that pertaining to the care of men is just the other part.
You seem to me to put that very well, but still I need more information. I do not know yet what's meant by saying care, for you do not mean care of gods like care of other things, as when we say that many don't know how to care for horses, but the breeder does.
That is the way I mean it.
So by care of horses, you refer to breeding them.
I do.
Nor is it true that everyone can care for dogs, although the hunter can.
That's true.
So hunting is the care of dogs?
Yes.
Raising cattle is the care of cattle?
Quite so.
While piety and godliness is caring for the gods, O Euthyphro, is that what you are telling me?
It is.
Care has, it seems, in each case this effect. Its purpose is the good and benefit of what is cared for, as when breeders care for horses who derive a benefit, becoming better. Do you not agree?
I do.
So dogs derive a benefit from breeding, just as cattle do from raising, and similarly in the other cases. Or do you think the purpose of the care is harming what is cared for?
No, by Zeus.
It aims to benefit what's given care.
Of course.
Then it is true that piety, the care of gods, exists to benefit the gods and make them better. Do you think that acting piously improves the gods?
By Zeus, I don't.
Nor do I think that this is what you meant. Far from it, but that's why I asked you what you meant by care of gods. I did not think you meant this kind of care.
Right, Socrates, I don't mean care like that.
All right, but then what kind of care of gods amounts to piety?
Well, Socrates, the kind of care that slaves take of their masters.
I understand. It's like a kind of service that's given to the gods.
That's what I think.
Now what of giving service to the doctors? What goal does this advance? Achieving health, do you agree?
I do.
And what of service to shipbuilders? What goal does it advance?
Well, clearly, Socrates, to build a ship.
And what of housebuilders? Does serving them advance the building of a house?
It does.
Then tell me, my good sir, what is the aim advanced by giving service to the gods? It's clear that you must know this, since you claim of all men you know most of the divine.
In that I tell the truth, O Socrates.
So tell me then, by Zeus, what worthy aim do gods achieve by using us as servants?
What aim? Well, many fine things, Socrates.
And so do generals, nonetheless, my friend. It seems their main concern is victory in war. Is this not so?
Of course it is.
The farmers, too, achieve fine things, I think. But what they do is mainly to produce food from the earth.
Quite so.
Well, then, how would you summarize the things the gods achieve?
I told you, Socrates, not long ago. It takes hard work to apprehend these things precisely. But to make a simple claim, I say that if a man knows what to say and what to do that's pleasing to the gods in prayer and sacrifice, the things he does are pious actions and that they preserve both private houses and public affairs. The opposite of pleasing acts like this are the impious ones that overturn and ruin everything.
You could have said in many fewer words, if you had wished, exactly what I asked, O Euthyphro. But you don't want to teach me, that is clear. You were about to do so, but you stopped. If you had carried on, I should by now have learned from you enough so I could say, at last I know the truth of piety. At all events, he who loves inquiry must follow his beloved where it leads. Once more, then, I will ask, what do you say that piety and that the pious are? Are they a knowledge of the way to pray and sacrifice?
They are.
To sacrifice means give the gods a gift, whereas to pray means begging from the gods.
Yes, Socrates.
It follows from this claim that piety means knowing how to give the gods a gift and how to beg from them.
You understand quite well what I have said, O Socrates.
And that's because I'm focused on your wisdom. I concentrate upon it, so no word you speak is lost by falling to the ground. But tell me, what's this service to the gods? Is it to beg from them and give to them?
It is.
To beg correctly is to ask the gods to give us what we need.
What else?
To give correctly is to give them what they need from us, for it would not do well to give a gift to anyone who does not need it.
That's true, Socrates.
It seems that piety must be a sort of skill that men use in their trading with the gods.
Yes, call it trading, if that's what you like.
There's nothing that I like but what is true. But tell me, what's the benefit the gods derive from gifts we give them? What they give to us is obvious for all to see. For us, there is no good we don't receive from them. But what's the benefit they gain by what we give them? Or is it the case that we have such advantage over them in trading that they give us all these blessings, receiving nothing from us in return?
Do you suppose, O Socrates, the gods enjoy a benefit from what we give them?
What is the purpose of our gifts to them, if not to give a benefit?
What else than honor, reverence, and gratitude, as I just said?
The pious, Euthyphro, is pleasing to the gods, but doesn't give a benefit. It isn't dear to them.
I think of everything, in fact, it is most dear to them.
So once again we see the pious is just this, dear to the gods.
Most certainly.
Will you now be surprised to find your arguments have moved about instead of staying put? Will you complain that I am Daedalus who makes them move, although you are the one with greater skill than Daedalus, and move them in a circle? Or don't you realize that our argument has gone around returning to its start? You must remember that before we said the pious and the God-beloved were not the same, but were in fact two different things. Or do you not remember this?
I do.
Do you not realize then that you now say that what the gods hold dear is just the pious? Is this the same as God-beloved or not?
It is the same.
So either we were wrong when we agreed before, or we were right and now we're wrong.
The statement seems correct.
So let's go back, investigate again. What is the pious, as I won't give up before I've learned this. Please don't think I am unworthy. Rather, focus your attention and let me know the truth. If any man knows this, you do. I must not let you go, like Proteus, before you've spoken it. If you had no clear knowledge of these things, of piety and of impiety, you never would have dared to prosecute your aged father as a murderer. While taking up the grievance of a servant, fear of the gods would have dissuaded you from risking that this action might be wrong, and that you might feel shame before men's eyes. However, I am aware that you believe you have clear knowledge of impiety and piety. So tell me, Euthyphro, don't hide from me the knowledge that you have.
Perhaps some other time, good Socrates. I'm in a hurry now, and I must go.
All right, but you have dashed my hopes, my friend. I thought that I could learn from you about the nature of the pious and impious, and so escape from Meletus's charge by showing him that I'd acquired wisdom about these matters from you, Euthyphro, that I no longer would be ignorant and carelessly inventive in these matters, and thus throughout my life would be improved.